From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, a call for an emergency transfusion to schools.
Michigan is now in the bottom five states in the country for the gap between affluent school districts and high-poverty school districts.
An advocacy group says funding can't wait. Also on the show, coronavirus may sound scary, but influenza is truly scary in terms of Michigan's public health. Can quarantines truly help for either condition? One organizer fresh from a march in Washington reflects on the costs of activism, and a staged reading of an FBI interrogation takes us inside one intelligence contractor's choice.
We edited nothing. We stage every single word that's there and no more and no less.
The story of reality winner, ripped from the headlines. All that's coming up on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. As Governor Gretchen Whitmer prepares to deliver her second State of the State address on Wednesday, public school budgets are not far from anyone's mind. Enrollment continues to drop. Federal changes in standardized testing have reset the goalposts, and Michigan has its own test-related mandates looming. Against this background, Education Trust Midwest has taken a unique stance. Normally, it's a voice in education policy debates, but for the first time in its 24-year history, it's calling for a substantial reinvestment in schools. Amber Arellano is the executive director of Education Trust Midwest. I asked her about the questions that the latest EdTrust inquiry was setting out to answer.
So we developed this report with two national organizations that have deep expertise in school finance and public education systems. And we did that over the last year because we began looking at new research that was finding that Michigan is now in the bottom five states in the country for the gap between affluent school districts and high poverty school districts.
So this is a little bit more subtle way of measuring than just looking at, say, graduation rates, which are around 80%, and more a function of measuring need with funding for schools in need, right?
Yeah, and that's a different approach for us. You know, we've been one of the organizations leading a campaign to make Michigan a top 10 education state for several years now. And we've never focused on funding for good reason. I mean, there are many factors that lead to educational improvement. And when you look at leading states around the country, money's not the only thing that matters. But it does matter, and it especially matters for kids who have special needs or challenges. You know, for example, Michigan now has a third grade reading and retention law in place. And you think about kids that have particular challenges in learning how to read, like dyslexia. If you're in second grade and you're having trouble even seeing the letters straight,
that's where the rubber's hitting the road.
Yeah. And yeah. If schools don't have the capacity and the resources to get the additional supports that kids like that need, then they're not going to learn how to read. And that has a huge impact not only on their lives, but it's a huge impact on our economy.
There's a lot to say about the remedies and conclusions in this report, but I just wanted to ask a bit about methodology first. What if Michigan's status in the ranking that you mentioned has more to do with the progress of lower-rated states who have managed to improve their status while Michigan's numbers were staying roughly the same?
Well, for performance in terms of achievement, that is part of what's going on. When you look at the overall data trends, it's not just that Michigan has been stagnant or slightly declining in performance. It's also that there are so many other states that they are growing, their students learning so much more rapidly than ours. And so that's partly like if you imagine a group of swimmers in a set of lanes, you know, that Michigan is going about the same speed where all these other swimmers are going faster and faster and faster, and we're falling farther behind. And I think what the evidence is suggesting is that, especially for kids in low-income communities, in rural communities, kids with disabilities, that money can make a difference when it's invested effectively and thoughtfully. And so in this report, we're not only calling for Michigan to catch up with the top leaders in the country to invest in those students, we're also saying, let's do that thoughtfully. Let's do that smartly. Let's make sure that we're also putting systems in place to hold districts accountable for using those dollars in a way that evidence shows that actually improves learning outcomes.
The recommendations that this report puts forward are generally organized around how the state can help high-poverty schools. Don't these schools already get extra federal funding, so-called Title I money?
They do, and that's an important observation to make. What we know, though, is that even when we only look at state and local dollars, Michigan is in the bottom five states in the country. There was a new national report found that Michigan got a D for the gap between wealthier school districts and high-poverty school districts. So if you think about the ability for working class communities, post-industrial communities, places like Flint or Lansing, post-recession, following Michigan's Great Recession, a lot of those communities lost a lot of their tax base. You know, I grew up on the border of Pontiac and Waterford. During the recession, about a dozen old auto plants were closed in Pontiac, including my dad's former auto plant. And those were really critical part of the tax base in lots of communities, right? Wyoming and West Michigan, outstate, like in old automotive communities and other industrial communities. And now those communities don't have a lot of that tax base left. So in the leading states around the country, in places like Massachusetts, state leaders have said, okay, we know that many of these communities are not Birmingham's. They're not East Grand Rapids. They don't have the local tax base in an era of globalization to invest more of their local dollars in their students to make sure that they're achieving at high levels. So we're going to step in and we're going to help fill that gap because ultimately it's not fair to kids if there's several thousand dollars less being invested in their schools and in their futures. And again, like we've said before, like this is not just about those kids and those families or even those communities. If Michigan actually closed the gap and how well our students are learning compared to the students in leading states, we're talking about a $27 billion difference in our economy. So it's a talent issue. It's an economic vitality issue.
One other recommendation suggests publishing data that's actually easy to follow to track how schools are spending state money. Anyone who's lost brain cells reading a district budget can tell you they can be very complicated, and administrators often have to draw from multiple funding sources to cover the costs, even for something as simple as one staffing position. Is there a way to express spending more simply?
Massachusetts is another leader in this. Illinois has been really making great strides in this. Your point about transparency is really important, especially for local parents and advocates. There aren't enough journalists in the state to dig into every school district's budgets and spending plans. But for example, let's say the state made a $400 million investment in improving third grade reading. Districts were required to develop a plan and a plan for evaluating and reporting out on how it was doing based on those benchmarks and in actually improving reading, and then had to report to their community every year. Here's what we set out to do. Here's how we promised to spend the money. Here's what we said that was going to be improved. We're going to raise reading levels by X amount, and here's how we did. And by making that more transparent and actually requiring educators to report on that, we think would be a powerful lever for not only for holding districts accountable for the work, but also for engaging communities, right? Engaging parents, engaging local stakeholders in that improvement process so that people are working together toward those goals.
Over a period of about a dozen years, Michigan's funding for schools grew by 26%, unadjusted for inflation. Test scores fell just a little bit during that time. There was an analysis done by the Mackinac Center in 2016 that found no relationship between additional spending and a series of about two dozen different measures of achievement. How can we reconcile that with what may be a glaring need for more school funding?
I think it's really important, as we have done for many years, to be really clear that money alone is insufficient for transforming learning and teaching. And what we know is that if the money's not used effectively, if it's not used for very high leverage strategies, that's true. I mean, you can invest a lot more money, but it doesn't necessarily mean that learning is going to improve. But we also know that, based on research, that there are particular groups of students where money can have a much, much greater impact. For example, students with disabilities. If a student literally is unable to get inside of a classroom because of physical challenges, or if a teacher is not trained to provide the kind of support that a particular student needs, for example, if a student is learning English, in high poverty and working class communities in Michigan, the challenges, especially around talent, are so severe right now. Schools going through 2 and 3 substitute teachers in 1 year because of the gaps in the salary differences, right? It's really hard for communities like Grand Rapids to attract and retain great talent in classrooms when they pay thousands of dollars, sometimes even more than $10,000 less than suburban communities. We can't ask teachers to be martyrs, right? Like, I mean, they have families too. They need to save for college, right? They need to take care of their kids and their families just like other parents do. And so those kinds of resource gaps can have a really, really big impact on terms of quality in the education and the instruction that we're providing kids in classrooms.
We're finally at a point where none of the state's districts are in full-on oversight state of emergency. Revenues are projected to rise a bit in the near future. How do you make the case to the state to make the kind of investments you're talking about, which would be substantial?
Yeah. The conversation in Lansing is very much about not only the what, like, and how much, but how. And in this report, we don't lay out exactly how. Like, we feel like that is a state leadership conversation. We have ideas to contribute to that. But those are really tough questions. What we're trying to do here is to say, let's make a down payment for the future. Let's put a plan into place to address the investment challenge that we have in the state. You know, Massachusetts, for example, last year passed sweeping legislation to overhaul its funding system. They're saying we can't do this overnight. It's going to take time. They're made a commitment to implement that over 7 years. And so we're saying, yeah, that's probably about the time period that Michigan will need to do this as well. But if we start now, if we start thinking about what are these systems of transparency and accountability that we should put into place, piloting, for example, how would we make sure that new dollars are being invested properly? I think it would actually help the conversation in Lansing, which, as you know, has been a little slow and stuck as leaders on both sides of the aisle try to find out where's the balance between questions of accountability and questions of more investment. And with this report, we're saying it's a both and. It's not an either or. It's really a both and. Let's figure that out together.
Amber Arellano is Executive Director of Education Trust Midwest. The Trust's study on education funding and disparities in school funding in Michigan, it's, of course, at the Trust website, and you can also find a link by going to Michigan Radio's website. Amber, thanks again.
Thank you.
This Wednesday, Governor Whitmer will likely address education funding during her State of the State speech. You can hear it here on Michigan Radio starting at 7 p.m. Coming up, a play on stage in Ann Arbor turns an FBI interrogation into a meditation on civic responsibility.
I always say I couldn't write that monologue. She gives this completely heartfelt, succinct reason of why she made the choice to leak that document.
That's next on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside for Michigan Radio. I'm April Baer. Golam Rabbani celebrated the grand opening of his restaurant this month. He's not a chef. Golam was a human rights lawyer, forced out of Bangladesh for opposing the government. Now he's making a leap into the restaurant business. Interlochen Public Radio's Noel Riley attended the opening of Taste of India at Grand Traverse Mall.
Smells of curry, turmeric, and cumin fill the air. Golam Rabbani and his family give guests free samples of traditional Indian food. Samosas, chicken tandoori, and buttered chicken. He spent his entire life helping an ethnic minority group displaced by the Bangladesh-Pakistan War in 1971. Now he owns a restaurant.
My real motto is to satisfy the people, to satisfy the client who are taking the food from me.
Golam worked for the Bangladesh Supreme Court until 2015, advocating for basic rights of minorities. He and his family fled the country after Golam ran for an opposition campaign for political office. His 16-year-old son, Anaf Rabbani, remembers it well.
So when he ran against it and protested against the government to stop being corrupt, change their ways, they did not like that. So they basically forced us out.
His family went into hiding and then went to New York City in 2015. but it was too expensive. So a friend convinced them to move to Port Huron, where Gollum's wife, Tangini, started working at an eyebrow salon. She then wanted to open her own salon and found a spot in the Grand Traverse Mall. Their son, Anoff, likes it.
TC was a bit more welcoming than Port Huron. We like crowded places and is a bit more diverse than Port Huron. There's more people, and the Cherry Fest was amazing. That's our highlight of the year, probably.
A group of 10 family and friends from Bangladesh were inspired by Gollum and his wife, so they moved to Traverse City this fall. Now, together, they will soon have 4 businesses in the mall: the salon, a mobile phone kiosk, the Indian restaurant, and soon a Thai restaurant. The idea for an Indian restaurant came out of Gollum's work with Justice for Our Neighbors, a group that helps immigrants with legal needs. He says people there always asked him to cook Indian food. It wasn't long before he and his wife started having people over to eat.
And everybody react, oh my God, awesome. That's a good signal that we can start these types of food business or food store.
Mall patron Jamie Brantz is happy for the extra choices.
I live in Metoskey, so we have even less ethnic food, so this is really exciting.
For Gollum and his family, they're just happy they found a welcoming community to serve.
That's reporter Noelle Riley with a story that was featured on Points North, a weekly show and podcast from Interlochen Public Radio. In 2017, a 26-year-old former Air Force translator with the almost unbelievable name of Reality Winner was doing contract work for U.S. intelligence services. That summer, government prosecutors launched a sensational case charging Winner with leaking a classified report on Russian hacking, a report that ended up as part of a story on the news website The Intercept. She pled guilty and is currently serving a 5-year prison term. Winner's case became the basis of a play that's on stage this month. The University of Michigan's University Musical Society is in the midst of No Safety Net, a theater festival showcasing provocative productions, including this play called Is This a Room? Reality Winner Verbatim Transcription. It is, as you may guess, an onstage word-for-word reproduction of what passed between Reality Winner and interrogators with the FBI. Tina Satter is the show's director, and Tina, I guess we shouldn't say writer. How about creator?
Yes, conceiver, creator.
Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
How did you become aware of Reality Winner's story?
It was when she first was arrested, I, like many people, didn't really pay attention. Like, it was like this news blip. Her name, of course, caught my attention, and I very, very vaguely knew of it. And then 6 months later, so that happened, that she was interrogated and arrested in June 2017. And then 6 months later, in December 2017, in a total free reading mode, I stumbled upon this article about her that was in New York Magazine that had the title, America's Biggest Terrorist Has a Pikachu Bedspread. And I was immediately intrigued by the title. And then as soon as I started reading about this young woman in this great piece, was like, oh my gosh, this person's fascinating. And I had no idea about this. And then that had a link to the transcript of the FBI interrogation of her that day.
Was reading that transcript the moment that you decided to take it to the stage?
Totally. I mean, even the first page of it, which has like stamped at the top, and it's a scanned PDF that was on Politico at the time. It said verbatim transcription as if that was the title. And then where like there'd be like a character list, it said participants and listed the 4 people that is how we stage it now. And then as soon as I started reading it on the page, because it captures all the language, it captures like where they stutter or cough. So I'm really interested in the level of language as someone who's also a playwright. And having just read this article where I know she's in jail, but as I'm reading this and she's like obfuscating and avoiding getting caught, I'm like, this is like a thriller, like set in one room. And yeah, I was really thinking of it as a play almost 2 or 3 pages into reading the scanned PDF.
Let's listen to a little bit of the dialogue. We're going to hear a point in the play in which the agents have been questioning Winner for some time. Everybody's getting a little tired. Here it is.
Okay. Is there anything else you want to tell me about? Say, talk about why?
No, that day, that week, it was just too much to sit back and watch and think, why do I have this job if I'm just gonna sit back and be helpless? And I just thought that was the final straw.
It was just something that just kind of did it. Because you don't seem like the type to do this. I believe it. I want to believe it.
I'm not. You know, I want to go out with our special forces. I mean, that's why I got out of the Air Force. That's why I'm here in Augusta. I wanted my clearance back so I could apply for a deployment. And it was just at a time when I wasn't applying for any deployments. And I had, you know, 7 or 8 months left of a job that didn't mean anything to me because it's Iran and I'm a Pashto linguist. Like, what am I doing translating Farsi? And I just felt really hopeless. And seeing that information that had been contested back and forth and back and forth in the public domain for so long, trying to figure out with everything else that keeps getting leaked and keeps getting released, why isn't this getting out? Why isn't this getting out there? Why can't this be public?
That's an excerpt from Is This a Room? Reality Winner verbatim transcription. And my guest today is the director of the show, Tina Satter. Tina Satter, it's really stunning how well just a transcript, what might be a pretty dry document, lends itself to that dramatic reading.
Yeah, I mean, that point especially is like, I always say I couldn't write that monologue. It's where reality, she's already admitted actually at that point. It's pretty late in the play. And then they say, why did you do it? And she gives this completely heartfelt, succinct reason of why she made the choice to leak that document. And it's pretty incredible, I think.
How much editing did you have to do with the transcript?
We edited nothing. We stage every single word that's there and no more and no less.
How did you handle redacted information? There must have been some things that weren't fully spelled out.
Sorry. For the redactions, that was a whole, like, sort of, it's mostly a design thing at the end of the day. This, like, really calibrated thing we found by experimenting that's a mix of light and sound that treats those places that when you were reading it, you'd come to the page and there would be that black rectangle that covered parts of the text. So we honor those too in the performance, again, with this technical choice.
What did you notice about the way the FBI agents interacted with Reality Winner and sort of how they moved through the conversation?
The most striking thing is the mix between this total, almost banal chit-chat over, like, her pets, things like, we're all dog people, asking her about where she does CrossFit, mentioning that they do things like that, mixed with then these switches into, like, this pretty hardcore questioning and this really repetitive nature of then repeating and slightly twisting sentences. So it's this real dance for them and, frankly, also for reality, as you see her trying to sort of stay one step ahead of them, as we sort of think is happening in that, as they move between those two modes.
And ultimately break her down.
Ultimately, they break her down.
What did you notice about this young woman, Reality Winner?
She's very funny. She's got this great, dry sense of humor that literally is kind of seen as you spend as much time with We Did It as this transcript, and then ultimately with reality, you see it from start to finish, even through after the darkest moments of that interrogation. She's still got this great, kind of very realistic sense of humor. She's incredibly smart. I mean, she just kind of is. If you speak three Arabic languages at the level she does, you're smart. But you really can sense a human being. What's so incredible about this transcript, you can sense a human being trying to, like, kind of keep themselves alive and keep themselves alive around a certain set of, like, honor, like trying to navigate that. And again, because we've spent so much time with this, with how this language falls out on the page, we really feel you can sort of track where she's trying to, like, give them a little something to see if she can get out of it, maybe give them something to like actually honor what they're asking her. Because she's a military person who understands she should probably try to do the right thing. So you just see this really complicated, humane person that day. And because of the exposition involved in a transcript, you also get all these amazing details that she teaches yoga and owns three guns, one of which is pink. Like, there's just this incredible amalgamation of like a very rich human being that comes out in these 87 pages.
One of the things that I took away from the play is how very young she was. Do you think she understood the magnitude of what she was doing?
I mean, that's something that's so hard for us to answer. I think parts of her heart for sure understood that. And I think she probably, my personal thing is, I don't think she probably would have set out to be the martyr she's become. I don't think it was as a planned scope-wise and stuff as like a Snowden where she was ready to like kind of throw all her of her life away for this choice. But I think there's clearly a gray area in there because, again, she's a really intelligent person. I mean, and as she goes on to say in that clip, or actually maybe in the clip you played, there's a feeling of hopelessness, like this potentially really patriotic threat of, I want to do right by this country. That's what I've already done. I can see this information that seems to be in total conflict with what we are being told as a country. As she puts it, why can't this be public?
Did you make any contact with Reality Winner or with the FBI to answer some of the questions you had about the situation?
We have never talked to the FBI, and Emily Davis, who plays Reality, did have some correspondence with Reality when she was in prison, but we never have explicitly asked her or her family, who we're also in touch with, about this day. We've just taken all the information. They know we're doing this. We're always extremely explicit. We have a very nice relationship with her family, but we've always just drawn it from the transcript, which operates as our script, and never asked. I mean, she's shared some information in those letters with Emily, very anecdotally, and it kind of incredibly tracks with what we'd already sort of made or felt, because she is so clearly rendered, actually, in that transcript.
No questions for the FBI at all? Or was it just that you felt that they probably wouldn't answer anyway?
I don't know. We didn't really do dramaturgy in that way. We did it very old-fashioned, like this is a play. I didn't spend any time looking up what does an interrogation actually look like. We just took all of what it could feel and look like from like our imaginations and like, again, really using this script. We did look up, there's a lot of jargon in it. So we looked up like so that the actors could say things like PKI password and high side, et cetera, you know, honesty and truthfulness to their own performances. But again, they're rendered really incredibly too. You can really see some version of what it appears those two men, the main agents, are up to that day and how they're operating from the page. So that felt like what we wanted to do. We weren't trying to do some larger, it's not actually some document of like, how does the FBI operate? It is a theatrical interpretation of this hour and a half in this young woman's life.
How does directing a show like this, you know, based on a transcript, differ from something that you might have written yourself?
The first biggest thing is that when I write it myself, I can change the words, and often do change the words as we figure out what's working or doesn't work or what's funnier or what we can add or cut, because I give myself that freedom. With this, there's a way we've almost treated it, I think Emily Davis is the one who said it, as a canonical text, as if this transcript is Shakespeare and we have to muscle through and make all of it work. I mean, I did think originally we were going to have to cut some of it. There's like, I thought this can't hold, it's too dry, it's too repetitive in the nature of being this interrogative pattern that repeats. But we just tried to keep muscling through and making it work. And I think that's the biggest difference between when I direct my plays prior, which I wrote all of them. I still try to sort of stick to what was written, but you just have more flexibility to recreate it.
The U.S. Senate is almost literally, as we speak, deliberating events that are relevant to the subject matter of the play. How does this rendition of Reality Winner's story handle the question about whether she did the right thing in the end?
it's a question still. And this, we feel the strongest thing we can do artistically is put this into the conversation, offer a much deeper read of this moment that no one would ever, even if you read that reality profile and read more stories on it, you're, to get this gift of knowing what like it is like when the FBI interrogates someone who leaked proof of Russian interference in our election, and this one-hour conversation that ensues is like just showing that and showing the machinations of the state in that moment and not saying they're good or bad. Obviously, reality is really complicated. She did break a law, but many people think for a right reason. Some people think, nope, there was a better way to do that, you know, that you run the info up the flagpole or something. So we want to just put it out there and offer people more than a headline and offer a way their heart and brain can sit in live space watching this rendition of reality with other humans and think about all those issues that, yes, are literally at play by the hour right now in our lives. So, yeah, it's pretty crazy.
Tina Satter, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Tina Satter is the co-founder of Half Straddle, the company that's staging Is This a Room? Reality winner verbatim transcription in Ann Arbor this week. It's part of the No Safety Net Theater Festival. We really do love having your input on the show. Have you seen a play lately that you feel gets directly to the zeitgeist? What are your ongoing concerns about election year? The fast way to reach us is on the socials. You can feel free to follow me on Twitter. I'm at April Baer. That's B-A-E-R. Or you can follow Michigan Radio on Facebook. And don't forget to sign up for the Stateside Podcast on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or wherever you listen. Coming up, across the political spectrum, activism and its personal costs.
I've sacrificed a traditional career and a paycheck. My activism makes me step out of my comfort zone nearly every single day. I've lost relationships.
That's next here on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Over the weekend, thousands of people attended the annual March for Life in Washington, D.C. Whenever you watch videos of demonstrations, most of those people you're looking at are not compensated. Kristen Polo is the executive director of Protect Life Michigan. She does get a paycheck for that job. She works with the campus pro-life groups around the state. But she came up, like many who do activism, as someone ready to dedicate hours, months, years of her life to a cause. You might have heard last week on the show, we marked Angela Davis's recent visit to Michigan, talking with a young activist about some experiences she's had organizing for progressive causes. At that time, Vidya Aravind spoke about moments of isolation and the ways that other people sometimes define her by activism work. So we were curious what Kristen Polo would say about how she's dealt with those same issues, going back to the days when she was working on a volunteer basis. Kristen, welcome. To begin with, tell us about what set you on your activist path.
Well, I first got involved as a high school student in the pro-life movement. I was really convicted about abortion, especially after hearing the testimonies of many women who had experienced abortions themselves and so deeply cared and wanted to do something to help women who felt like they had no other option, wanted to stand up against this injustice. And so I started to get a little bit involved in high school and even deeper in college, and then ultimately was called to work full time after graduating from college, and I've worked in the pro-life movement since 2013.
What kinds of activities were you doing when you first started, and I guess through the course of your career as an activist?
I first got involved on the political side of things. I did a lot with Right to Life of Michigan, knocking doors for different pro-life candidates. I volunteered working at the pro-life fair booths, and from there started to get more and more involved with my peer group. I led a pro-life group with other high school students and then did the same in college. I went to the University of Michigan, studied political science there, and started to do a lot of outreach on my campus to raise awareness about abortion, help people understand what they believe about the issue more deeply, and engage in dialogue with my fellow peers.
So it sounds like this has been something like a 10-year journey for you.
It has, yes.
What else has been happening in your life during that time?
Well, a lot. graduating high school, graduating college, getting married, starting my career. There's been a lot of change throughout all of this over the last nearly 15 years. But throughout that entire time, I've stayed heavily involved. In fact, I think for some people, activism seems to have this pull that you care a little bit and you get involved a little bit, and then it just keeps going deeper and becomes more and more. And, you know, I think about my life today and I can't separate who I am from this work that I do. It's such a heavy part of my life because it's a part of who I am today, and the way that I live and how I see myself is as an activist in many ways.
Do you feel like there have been some costs to you for activism?
There certainly have. For me, some of the costs of activism have been sacrificing comfort. I've sacrificed a traditional career and a paycheck. I've had to come to terms with the fact that my activism makes me step out of my comfort zone nearly every single day. I've lost relationships.
When you talk about sacrificing comfort, how did you imagine your professional life would be before you went full-time in movement?
I didn't ever intend to work in the nonprofit field. I had hoped to be an attorney. I was studying political science at the University of Michigan, intending to go down that route. So that was definitely a big career change.
When you say being an activist has taken you out of your comfort zone, could you give us some examples of that?
There's many different aspects to how being an activist has made me step out of my comfort zone. In some ways, it's the actual action of taking a stand. You have to put your fear aside and just be prepared to talk to different people, have difficult conversations. But it's also helped me step out of my comfort zone in other ways, simply by coming to the nonprofit field and taking this little tiny organization and having to grow it into something large and successful has been a challenge, because every day I've had to put on a different hat, whether it's social media or fundraising or public relations, whatever it may be. So it's come with a lot of challenges emotionally and professionally as well.
Can you give us an example of a difficult conversation that you've had to come to terms with?
A lot of the activism that I do is dialoguing with people who don't agree with me. So at Protect Life Michigan, we use a lot of different means to simply get people talking. Sometimes that's signs and showing up at different events. Sometimes it's putting tables up on campus or in other community areas to start conversations. And there have been a lot of difficult conversations because abortion is something that has touched different people's lives in many different ways. It can be sensitive whether you're pro-life or pro-choice.
Do you feel like activism has colored your interactions with other people or shaped relationships in other ways?
I do. Activism has both strengthened some relationships and it's also cost me others. I've lost really close lifelong friends who simply couldn't see past our differing opinions, even despite having a really deep love for one another. And I think that being an activist can amplify your differences, and that can be really hard for some people to take on. And so it can be a challenge for some relationships. Others, you know, you feel like you're on the front lines with them. So fellow activists, we kind of get it, right? Like we're buddies in that battle. And so sometimes there's a cost. Sometimes I think there can be a benefit as well. But I've even seen it cost relationships inside my own faith community because it's such a complicated topic. Even people who might be on the same page and have the same beliefs, even those relationships can be challenged at times.
How would you say you've coped with those costs?
There are days that are harder than others, days that I feel hurt and upset. But I think the reality is that the price I've paid for being an activist is still far less than what the victims of the injustice have lost. And I think no matter what you're an activist for, whether it's, you know, you see yourself as a pro-life activist or maybe it's some other issue, at the end of the day, I think for most, the cost is worth the reward, because we want to be those people in history who are willing to stand up and speak up and sacrifice anything in order to challenge the status quo and create change. And because I believe that lives are on the line every single day, if I have to sacrifice whatever it may be, comfort, relationships, so that someone else can live, I'm willing to do that.
Are there things that you've done to sort of, I mean, everyone, in addition to having a professional community, needs a community of friends. Are there things that you've done to sort of strengthen that community in your own life?
Absolutely. And I'm so thrilled to say that I have friends on both sides of the aisle with this issue who are pro-life and pro-choice. I think at the heart of it, just being able to understand one another and have conversations and love one another despite differences is really important. You know, I also have friends who are very outspokenly pro-choice and work for organizations like Planned Parenthood and are still able to maintain those friendships because of our ability to converse with one another and have those important conversations and learn from each other.
What would you say it's taken to maintain those friendships?
The ability to love each other despite our differences and be understanding. I really believe that opposite sides of any issue need to talk and learn from each other, because that's going to strengthen our understanding of each other and our own positions. So it's never been something I've been afraid of as an activist. It's actually one of my core drives, is to have effective dialogue with people who are different than me.
As a practical matter, I mean, are these people that you can like hang out with on the weekends?
Sometimes feel to me like I might be a little bit more open to that than they are, but that's okay. As I was thinking about this topic and the cost of activism, I was reminded, I've been watching this series on Netflix about World War II. I think a lot of people often think back to great injustices of the past, and we think, I would have done something. I would have spoken up. I would have taken action. But then somehow we fail to speak up or take action when we're faced with very real injustices of today. You know, there's so many things happening around us that we could be a part of and do something about, but many times we don't. And I think that's because doing so almost always comes at great personal cost. Speaking up against injustice is always going to cost us something, but we have to do it anyway. And so whether it's comfort or lost relationships or a traditional career path, I'm just reminded that all of that is worth it, because you get to be one of those people throughout history who is challenging the status quo, trying to change the injustice and make things better. And that would be my encouragement to people. Yeah, there's going to be personal costs. There always are, but it's worth it for sure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having this conversation. I appreciate it.
Kristen Polo is the executive director of Protect Life Michigan. The group works with the campus pro-life groups around the state. If you'd like to hear last week's interview with Vidya Aravind for a few different takes on a life in activism, go to michiganradio.org. The quarantine that's left millions in China confined to their homes sent a shiver around the world, but it's not an unprecedented step in dealing with infectious disease. University of Michigan history professor and physician Howard Markell notes in today's New York Times, the largest quarantine in human history has roots in medieval remedies for the plague. And he's with us now to talk more about quarantine history. Dr. Markell, welcome back.
Hi, April.
Where does the modern history of quarantines and public health begin?
Well, You know, people have always avoided the ill, you know, people who are sneezing and drippy and have funny rashes. You can find that in antiquity. But the word quarantine comes from Venice in the 1370s. They were combating a bubonic plague, the Black Plague of Europe that killed a third of Europe's population. And it means really, it comes from quaranta giorno, 40 days. So they closed their port for 40 days to all ships and goods. No one could come in, no one could come out. And there was no science behind that. They didn't know anything about microbes or bacteriology, but that's...
Yeah, this considerably predates the understanding of hand washing as central to...
But they knew, they didn't know about rats or lice or anything like that, but they knew it was catchy, that it went from person to person. And so they closed the ports, and that was thought to be the time it would burn out. Within about 30 years in 1400, they shrunk it to 30 days, and it's been fine-tuned and changed ever since, particularly post-germ theory era in the 1870s or 80s, where we try to fashion things based on the natural history of the microbe in question. And it's been used quite a bit and sometimes quite abused quite a bit as a social mechanism rather than a public health mechanism.
Well, you write that quarantines do have a way of targeting some populations unfairly. What outbreaks should inform our understanding of this?
Well, there are so many. I mean, we could talk for hours. But I wrote years ago a book about Russian Jewish immigrants in 1892. Who literally imported typhus fever into the Lower East Side of New York. And so the health department not only came down on the immigrants on these ships, but everyone they came in contact with who are also Jewish immigrants, but not the white New Yorkers who lived right near them. This happened again in 1892 in the fall when cholera spread from Hamburg to New York. The Russian Jewish immigrants, again, in steerage were quarantined on an island. They put these people on islands, but not the first-class passengers or people from Scandinavia. In 1900, it was an infamous bubonic plague epidemic in San Francisco, and the health department did a quarantine around Chinatown, but not the white San Franciscans who lived directly across the street. And this goes on and on. I mean, literally, you can find disenfranchised groups who are most vulnerable when a disenfranchised group or a so-called undesirable group is somehow perceived to be or actually connected to contagious diseases, bad stuff happens. And, you know, most recently, the worst thing was the AIDS epidemic in the early 80s with gay men and Haitians and intravenous drug users. A lot of stigmatization and problems as a result.
You say that you think the quarantine will not end corona as a health crisis. How come?
Well, because the proverbial cow has left the barn door. You know, it's very hard to decide when to pull that trigger to do a quarantine. And if it's going to work, you have to do it quite early because germs, frankly, travel. People go all over. And, you know, they go now at the speed of jet planes, not of ships. And at least 5 million people left Wuhan before the quarantine was ordered. And so quarantine officers or health officers are always a step or two behind the microbe. But in this case, it sounds like they were quite a bit steps behind the microbe. And as we've seen, it's already spread to different places around the world. And I suspect we'll see more cases.
Can we turn to the more pressing public health hazard here in Michigan, the thing that has killed more people this year already than coronavirus?
It's influenza.
Right. You knew where I was going.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's hard to get people vaccinated, overcoming their reticence to heed medical advice.
Right.
Does history tell us anything about overcoming those fears?
Well, it's difficult, and it's become even more difficult with anti-vaccination movements and distrust of medical authority and even medications and vaccines and so on. But I can tell you, every study, every major body of doctors and scientists, the National Academy of Sciences, the American Academy of Pediatrics, on and on and on, have found the flu vaccine to be safe and effective. Flu kills anywhere from 40 to 65,000 Americans every year. If you do get influenza, even if you don't die, God forbid you should die, you'll be sick as a dog. It's really a bad virus. So getting a vaccine is a very important thing to do. If you're over 60, you might want to get a pneumonia, a pneumovax vaccine. Hand washing, avoiding people who are coughing and sneezing, just like my mother always used to tell me before going to school. And if you are sick, stay at home. But yes, these are the things we should worry about. A feature of epidemic history is that the spectacular, that kills a few in a really remarkable fashion always gets our attention way out of proportion to the infections that kill us every day.
The United States public health infrastructure is somewhat less susceptible than China's to the bureaucratic forces that drove decision-making rather disastrously in the early days of SARS. We have just about a minute left. What do you see the vulnerabilities being here in the U.S.?
Well, the biggest vulnerabilities are that there's different levels of public health, local, state, and federal. And the feds can only come in when they're invited to a state situation by law. The internecine battles between these agencies often cause problems. And also, you have to get public buy-in. People have to cooperate, and we have to work to communicate, just as we're doing right now, the importance of public health. You know what I tell people all the time? When you pay taxes for a fire department and you don't have a fire, you don't mind that because you have a fire department. And the same can be said about all of our public health departments from the local to the federal level. You don't hear about them when they're doing their job well, and that's the way it's supposed to work.
Dr. Howard Markel, professor of medical history at the University of Michigan, good to see you.
Good to see you.
Quick update on the three possible cases of coronavirus here in Michigan. The State Department of Health and Human Services announced today all three cases have come back negative. I'm April Baer. We'll see you tomorrow.